Common Sense Conversations is a production of Taxpayers for Common Sense. Independent, nonpartisan, facts, and common sense since 1995.
Hello, and welcome again to Common Sense Conversation. We really appreciate your joining us. This is Ryan Alexander. I'm president of Taxpayers for Common Sense. We are a national budget watchdog. We look out for the American taxpayer and try to find wasteful, not smart spending or tax breaks throughout the federal budget. With me today is Wendy Jordan, Senior Policy Analyst.
Hello.
Steve Ellis, Executive Vice President.
Hey there, folks.
And Josh Sewell also.
Hello. Happy to be here.
Yeah, there we go. So we're going to really nerd out today. We're going to talk about kind of some of the statutes and policies that help enforce the idea that Congress has the power of the purse. If you think about the last, you know, several weeks and couple months in the news, you know, there's been a lot of news about a lot of things, but there's been a lot of news about the president trying to spend money or withhold money to achieve the goals that he wants that haven't necessarily been expressed by Congress. And, you know, one thing that in the Constitution, Congress is the first branch. It's Article 1, and it's very clear that they need to appropriate funds for anybody to spend them. So we've talked about the Anti-Deficiency Act in the past, but I'm going to hand it over to Wendy to do a little bit of an overview of the Anti-Deficiency Act as a reminder, if you're not thinking about it every day like we are, and also the Impoundment Act, which is kind of a related statute that has come into play in the last couple weeks.
Right. Thanks, Ryan. So the Anti-Deficiency Act is one of the federal statutes codifying the constitutional mandate that Ryan just laid out, giving the legislative branch primacy in writing legislation that funds the activities of the federal government. The Anti-Deficiency Act says federal employees cannot spend money in excess or advance of a congressional appropriation. So if an Appropriations Act passed by the Congress and signed into law by the president provides the Navy with, let's say, $50 million for widgets, the contracting officer may not spend $51 million on widgets. So you cannot spend either prior to the beginning of the fiscal year, which would be in advance, or in excess, so $51 million in the example that I'm giving you, on widgets. But the inverse is also forbidden. And if the contracting officer decides, after the appropriations bill has been passed by the Congress and signed into law by the president, that he only wants $47 million worth of widgets, he or she can't simply ignore the Appropriations Act and say, all right, I thought I needed $50 million worth of widgets, I only need 47, so that's all I'm gonna spend. That authority does not reside in the executive branch. And that's where the rules regarding impoundment come into play. The Congressional Budget and Impoundment Control Act of 1974 is the full name of the legislation.
I'm going to pause for a second and turn to Steve for a little history on the Congressional Budget Control and Impoundment Act, because I just know he knows it off the top of his head.
Well, one thing is that you know, we frequently cite the Congressional Budget Office, and that was an agency that was created by that law. And then also, you know, when you gave the example where it was they didn't want to spend the extra $3 million on widgets. But in reality, the law, though, was in response to President Nixon, who was refusing to spend some money on environmental programs. And that was when Congress enacted this law. And interestingly, the President Nixon signed that law as
right.
well. It didn't like go into effect over his veto.
Right.
So the executive branch effectively agreed to that. And then lastly, the 74 Act really created our existing budget process and the whole system and the deadlines. And that's something that we'll talk about a little bit more later in this conversation.
And the budget committees.
Correct.
Right. So President Nixon refused to spend those funds after he had signed the appropriations bill, as Steve said, water pollution projects at EPA. So under the procedures set out in the impoundment section of the new act, new in 1974, the administration must take specific actions if it decides it doesn't need or want to spend the money the way the Congress has appropriated it. So what they must do if they say, you know what, we said we needed, the Navy needed $50 million worth of widgets, we only need 47, they have to do one of two things. Either send a and in both cases, they have to send a formal message to the Congress. It's either deferring the obligation of $3 million worth of widgets, but any deferral can only last up to 45 days, and the deferral cannot cross over the end of an appropriations year, of a fiscal year. So 45 days or less, and in other words, basically you couldn't start a deferral prior to, what is that, August 15th? Yes, August 15th.
So that's that was a nod by Steve, for those of you who couldn't hear it.
Luckily, I'm sitting right next to Steve. The other possibility is a rescission message. And a rescission message would say, in this case that I've laid out, the Navy doesn't want to spend that last $3 million on widgets at all. Now, they can't simply send the message and Congress says, and that's the end of it. The Congress has to affirmatively agree to that rescission, and they can do that in one of two ways. One is pass a special bill of rescissions. Typically, it's a large rescission package for that that agency. Or they have to include those rescissions in another larger piece of legislation that is subsequently signed by the president. So that is the Anti-Deficiency Act and the Empowerment Act in a nutshell.
Very exciting. Before I...
She says that like it's not exciting.
It is exciting. and, you know, again, I feel like these are very technical things we're talking about, but this is a big constitutional principle. You know, I was just looking at the text because that's what we like to do. You know, the Constitution, Article 1, Section 9, no money shall be drawn from the Treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law. And a regular statement and account of receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. So, not really ambiguous. It's up to Congress. And if you go through the many other sections of Article 1, it's really clear Congress has the power. It's the, it's a foundational role that the framers gave to the lawmakers, not the executive. But it's not just in recent years that we have passed statutes to make sure that that is true. So I am going to hand it over to Josh to tell us about the Purpose Act.
Yeah, so the Purpose Statute actually is one of the first attempts to codify that appropriation cycle. So it actually, the statute says, appropriations shall be applied only to the objects for which the appropriations were made, except as otherwise provided by law. It's pretty simple, it's pretty clear. But what that basically means is, what Congress says matters. So you can only spend money on the things Congress says you can spend money on. And the corollary is you can't spend money on things that Congress says you can't spend money on. That's basically it. Now, it does get more complicated, but when it's clear, it's clear. And so in recent years, I can go through a specific example of where this was violated, but the Purpose Statute prohibits charging authorized items to the wrong appropriation and unauthorized items to any appropriation. So again, you have to have permission to do it. And once you have permission, you need to follow Congress's intent, and you can't commingle money. So the most recent example, one of the most recent examples of a violation happened in the last shutdown, when you had misuse of NPS, National Park Service, park entrance fees. So there's a law called the Federal Lands Recreation Enhancement Act. It was first passed, I believe, in 2004, and it has been extended every couple years since then. It basically allows a number of things and disallows a number of things. And one of the things it allows is an authorization for the collection of fees when you enter a park. So not every national park charges a fee, but many of them do. What Congress has said over the last 15 or so years is that of those funds that are generated by that user fee, you can use that money to do major maintenance. So there's this enormous backlog of projects in the Park Service. And so what you can use those funds for is to rebuild roads, to rebuild facilities, and some cultural programming. You cannot use them for anything else. And there's actually a whole list of things you can't use them for, but we don't need to get into that. During the last shutdown, instead of shutting the parks down like we have in every other shutdown that at least I'm aware of, the administration kept the parks open. And what they did is they used funds from the FLREA account to cover not major maintenance, but what they called daily maintenance, which means taking out the trash and cleaning the toilets. That's literally what they did. That's a violation of the Purpose Statute because there's a whole separate account passed every year in the appropriations process to fund daily maintenance activities for the National Park Service. So when you used one account, you violated the Purpose Statute because you violated the purpose of the FLRA, and you actually end up having an Anti-Deficiency Act violation because you didn't have authorization to spend money on the toilets, frankly. And so it's pretty simple in many respects. It is the purpose statute. It's the purpose that Congress wanted. That's what you have to follow. Now, of course, the GAO has a 420-page document explaining the details of how this has played out in reality. And really where it comes gets complicated is when you start in the larger pots of money, because Congress isn't going to go through and tell agencies how to spend every single dime. They're not going to tell you exactly which paperweights to buy. They may have some direction on segmented ladders and certain things, but that gets into a whole other issue.
Where the paperweights are made.
Exactly. And so when you have a thing such as such sums as necessary, or even when Congress says X billions of dollars for salaries and expenses, there's a whole process to figuring out how to spend that money. But again, it can't violate the purpose of that money. And just real quickly, I think it's important to show about, there's a three-part test when you get into this. So is there a particular statutory purpose or necessary expense? And then is the spending not prohibited by law, and is it not otherwise provided for? And again, there's a whole lot of examples for this, but it all comes down to when Congress takes the time in the legislation to specify how and where money is supposed to be spent, or even if it's not in the annual appropriations process, if they have authorizing language. So in all the farm programs, there's a farm bill. And we've had a farm bill every 5 years for about 80 years. There's a whole long history of how we're intending those to be spent. You have to follow that. If you don't follow those restrictions and opportunities, then it's a violation of the purpose statute.
And when was the purpose statute adopted?
It was 1809. So
pretty early
established.
Pretty quickly.
Right? Tried
pretty
and true.
Quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
So today
it would be some fancy acronym, you know, that would have right, come right. out to that. Although, but they weren't really as sophisticated.
You know, we could make up an acronym for purpose.
But at the same time, purpose kind of says what it means. So we like that.
I don't know. It'd be fun.
Before we move on to kind of budget process and some other changes, I want to just kind of open it up of, like, why do we care that Congress continues to have control over the money? You know, why does this matter? I feel like we've spent a lot of time this year talking about this idea that Congress controls money. And over our history, in the context of earmarks and other things, we've been accused of not caring about how much Congress controls money. So I just want to have a freewheeling and open discussion. Steve, calling on you first.
Oh.
Well, no, I think that the founders, if you go back and you look, that they were very concerned about having too strong of an executive. And actually, if you look at the constitutional conventions, or you read about the constitutional convention, you realize they spent almost all of their time on Article 1. And when you get to Article 2, it's very brief. You know, President Washington, George Washington, had to kind of figure out what exactly his role was going to be in the whole overall process. So really, that was all supposed to be vested in Congress. And, you know, as we've talked about in the past about the earmark issue, is that there are plenty of ways that Congress controls the purse strings. And it's just when you start micro-targeting, that was where we had some concerns, particularly if it looked like it was pay-to-play or we were picking projects on the basis of political muscle rather than project merit. But in the end of the day, Congress writes the appropriations bills, and the executive is supposed to, you know, signs them, and then they're supposed to be enacted the way they are. There are provisions to make adjustments, changes. There's emergency spending bills that come up for things that were unforeseen. But in the end, we're a country of laws, and we have a constitution, and Congress has been given that responsibility, and that keeps it closer to the people than having the executive decide every year where they're going to spend the money.
Wendy, you used to work for an appropriator.
I did.
Tell us your thoughts.
So my head is sort of exploding at the thought of the Congress not having the primary role in appropriations, because I guess it's what I came up with, as they would say in the South. My background is in Pentagon appropriations, so probably the most complex of the appropriations bills. I'm sure that I have my friends who do other things who would argue with me about that, but it's a very complicated bill, and of course it is in the area of discretionary spending the largest. So there's a lot of room for shenanigans, and if now we're, you know, around $700 billion in national security spending, and if any one of the branches, if either the legislative or executive branch had total control of that much money, that would be
bad.
That's a one way to say it. So you have the president, the services, and OMB, and the whole process by which the Pentagon budget is written. And then you have to have oversight of, you can't simply just say, yes, so that's how we're going to spend $700 billion this year. And there are tons of people like me and like Steve and like Josh at this table who have spent a lot of time looking at budget requests, and you too, Ryan.
Yes, that's okay.
And
me, sorry.
And we've spent a ton of time in different roles, and as you say, previously I was doing it for an appropriator, looking at the budget request and putting the imprimatur of Congress on that request.
Well, and I think it also matters because federal spending decisions are the product of a process, and that the process is what matters. And so if you're in an annual appropriations process and you're funding programs that were, again, I do a lot of work on the farm programs, we spend many hours debating people about how those programs should look. So then once you have those programs, Congress has put their stamp of approval on them, the president has signed them, bills authorizing those programs. When we start funding them, we need to follow those rules that we've created so that we have some certainty, certainly, but also because it's just the product of a process. And I think it helps to think about some specific examples.
I'm just going to jump in. It's a product of a process that involves the people who are most directly represent the voters.
Exactly. And so you have to have fidelity to that product, or else you just, that's just the way it has to work. And I think, we deal with this in disaster spending a lot.
Right.
And so there are rules that govern it. And one of those that, again, it comes to the purpose statute, to put a specific example on it, is there was a decision that there was authorized in appropriations funds to, quote, replace, unquote, or replace state roads, unquote, that were damaged by nearby federal dam construction. So when they wanted to, so you have this money, the federal government destroyed your roads, so we're going to rebuild your roads. We're not going to widen it to a four-lane highway. It was a two-lane highway before. We're not going to make it a four because you haven't been authorized to do that. That whole decision-making process of whether or not to make it a four-way highway and spend the money would have undercut an entire process that's in the transportation bill. So we have to follow the rules. We can't just, it's not the wild, wild west when you're in charge.
Okay, you're listening to Common Sense Conversations. I'm Ryan Alexander, president of Taxpayers for Common Sense, and we are having a great time talking about very, very nerdy and technical appropriations and budget statutes. And using that as a transition, Steve, there was a bill dropped last week in the Senate, a bipartisan bill, so let's just applaud everybody for working hard to work together, to reform the budget process. What's in it? What do we think about it? And how do you think it would address some of these issues about Congress protecting its responsibility and purview?
Sure. So the Bipartisan Congressional Budget Reform Act was introduced last week by Senate Budget Committee Chairman Enzi and his ranking member, Senator Whitehouse, a Democrat from Rhode Island, and several other Republicans and Democrats and independents were co-sponsors of that. And so, one thing is just right off the bat, certainly we applaud Chairman Enzi. There has been very few bipartisan substantive legislation that is advanced in Congress. And certainly we're excited to see budget reform because we know that while some good things came out of the 1974 Congressional Budget Act, it is a broken process. We've only passed appropriations bills on time before the beginning of the fiscal year four times in the more than 40-year history of the congressional budget process.
And the 74 bill was the last comprehensive budget process reform bill, right?
Correct. Right. And so what they've done in this is a certain thing. They've moved to a biennial, so every 2 years, budget process. It'll still be an annual appropriations process. They are also requiring that major affected committees, like the appropriations committees, that their chairman and the ranking member be ex officio members, so non-voting, but members of the budget committee to get some more buy-in into what they're doing. They also one of the requirements in each in the budget resolution is that there be a target established for debt to GDP ratio, which if you look at current day, well, last week we just went over $23 trillion in total federal debt. We're at a place where we haven't seen the debt to GDP ratio this large since immediately after World War II. So that's an important thing that basically, if you don't meet that debt to GDP target, it creates a special reconciliation process in the second year of the budget resolution to be able to target wherever you need to target the spending. There's also a budget resolution process and a budget reconciliation process that would be established if you got a vote of not just 60, but that 60 votes include at least 15 members of the minority party. So it's basically making sure that there is a buy-in from both Republicans and Democrats, that you couldn't have a straight party line change. They also made some
Not even just a straight party line. Not, you know, it used to be that you'd say a bipartisan bill means that if it's a Democratic bill, it has Senator McCain on it. A bipartisan bill, if it's a Republican bill, has maybe Senator Manchin on it. But there, that would count. And this is for meaningful representation of the minority.
Exactly. Exactly. And then also one thing that is an annual occurrence, or at least when they do the budget resolution, is it basically would curtail the Votorama, as it's called. And that is its technical name, Votorama. Where there's a whole bunch of basically gotcha amendments that are offered at the end of the budget resolution process that are really intended about catching the other side in a bad vote. And this is done by both Republicans and Democrats, and it's a waste of time. The members don't see the amendments until right before they emerge on the floor. So it doesn't really help the deliberative process, and it actually seems more likely to inflame tensions and disagreements. And so I also applaud them for getting that moved out of there. And then lastly, it calls for some more information from the CBO and the Government Accountability Office on ways to save money and to reduce waste or targets in various federal programs. And so that also is helpful. It's just kind of providing a menu for these for the committees and for the legislators. And then lastly, we know what we've got is broken. So, is this going to be a silver bullet? No, I don't think there is a silver bullet out there. But it's a change. I'm welcoming change. We hopefully can make it better and a more transparent and accountable process. And we can really start tackling, the fact that we've got an enormous deficit that almost topped $1 trillion this year, 4.6% of GDP, which is also a very high GDP deficit to GDP ratio. And so really trying to deal with some of those issues. And I think that Senator Enzi really sees this as a legacy issue for him. He's retiring at the end of this Congress. And it's something where he really went the extra mile to make sure that he was able to bring in members of the minority party and able to actually have something that he thought was durable and lasting.
So I think in terms of just, I don't want to go too cynical, but I mean, what do we
think? We would never do that.
I would never do that. what do we think it would take to pass a bill like this?
Well, I think that the bigger question is what would it take for the House to actually take it up?
Right.
And so that's I think that the Senate will get to this. I have a hard time seeing, we'll hear what comes out in the debate. They're voting on it in committee on Wednesday.
Right.
And we'll see what comes out of that. But, I wouldn't say that, it's a pretty broad political philosophy when you look across from Enzi to
right.
White House.
And so
I think that's going to give it some momentum. And I think that the Senate, especially there's a bunch of senators up for re-election this year that will want to show that they're doing something.
Right.
The lawmakers want to show that they're having trying to put the fiscal house in order. So I would think it has a pretty good chance in the Senate. Then the real question is what does Chairman Yarmuth, who's the chairman in the House, and what does he think? What does the leadership in the House think? Because the Democrats are in control there, and they could scuttle this if they want to, but I think that they put enough provisions in here that make it make it seem like you're not trying to stomp on the minority, you're not trying to drive through and go gut entitlements or anything like that. And so I think it'll be also be hard not to to take this up because it's clearly broken, the process.
So we got a couple of questions, one that is somewhat related to the overall budget and appropriations process. We've got a question about the kind of lobbying blitz on to shape a new ways and means tax extender package. We've talked about tax extender packages here before. One of the questions within the question is, you know, do we have any thoughts about why the extenders packages are still so energy heavy, and, you know, kind of what's our position on the never-ending, you know, cycle of extenders packages? So, Steve, you want to kind of do the big picture?
Sure. I mean, the tax extenders are the cockroaches of the Washington policy establishment. They seem to always survive. They catch a ride on various other pieces of legislation. I think there's only one time that I'm aware of that they actually passed on their own. They've always been on other big pieces of legislation, whether it was the bailout in 2008 or big fiscal deals at the end of the year. They often, they're a terrible way to do tax policy. They often expire and then are retroactively extended, clearly not giving any kind of
certainty.
Certainty or predictability to the taxpayers. But, you know, this hodgepodge has so many different provisions in it that they're able to just kind of log roll it through, because there's, you may not care about everything but one provision, you know.
Right.
And if you're Senator Wyden, you like the electric motorcycle one because basically makes some electric motorcycles is in Oregon, you know. And so it's going to help get your vote on that. And he's the ranking member on the Finance Committee, for instance. And I shouldn't just pick on him. I mean, there's a bunch of energy provisions in there that,
right,
you know, Senator Grassley would want, or other members. And so I do think that basically these are all sorts of provisions that haven't been able to get into the tax code, haven't actually derived that measure of permanence. And when you think about it, in 2017, for all its ills, which were significant, that was the largest rewrite of the tax code in 30 years. And so that if they couldn't actually get into the bill then, they should be expunged, in our opinion, you know. And so, but I do think that the energy provisions were sort of some of the later ones that were able to glom onto this process and then just keep getting extended and the arguments over it. And so we've been long on the record that we're opposed to the tax extender package, and that these need to
and
be looked
process.
At
the, and the process is
yep.
terrible.
Yep, exactly. And so it's become tired. It's also amazing. These were all expired. They're not coming up to being expired. They were expired a year ago. And
right.
So clearly nobody should be expecting that they were to be extended.
So we got one other question, which is a shift, but about the federal mineral royalties. Sorry about that. Tongue twister. About kind of why haven't we increased royalties to, you know, what other entities do, private lands, state lands, other nations, and pointing out that next year is the 100th anniversary of the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920, which, you know, just our supporters and listeners are as nerdy as we are. So why aren't we increasing royalties? What would it do? We totally think that we absolutely agree we should be increasing royalties. We've recently done a series of reports on a fiscal impact of different leasing practices state by state. You know, they all are using the same leasing practices on federal lands, but the consequences are different depending on what the nature of the state is. So, you know, in the state of New Mexico, where there's been a lot of oil and gas development, the fact that we haven't raised that royalty has, you know, meant billions and billions of dollars of foregone revenue. You know, onshore royalties are 12.5% and offshore are 18.75%, unless you were one of the leases offshore that had a clerical error and has royalty relief. So we 100% agree we need to bring federal mineral royalties kind of up to what would be a competitive market rate in, you know, as compared to private and state lands. And also that just so that taxpayers are being fairly compensated. This is, you know, we all own this land and these resources, and we shouldn't be giving them away. So any final profound thoughts from my friends and colleagues?
One thing I'd add is I said the extenders a year ago. Actually, I think it's a couple of years ago that they expired. So.
Right. I think that's right. Thank you again. Come back next month for another Common Sense Conversation. We will, you know, have many other interesting things to talk about by then, because I think we will have been through the continuing resolution, Thanksgiving, lots of things. So thanks for joining us, and have a good day.
You've been listening to Common Sense Conversations, a production of Taxpayers for Common Sense. To find out more about us, go to www.taxpayer.net.